hang on, mate. The bit in Fight Club where Edward Norton explains that that's how his company works with recalls, you know you're supposed to not like the company for that, right? You're not meant to go, yay, sensible capitalism for a happier Britain.
People of the world and possibly of other planets, welcome to Bad Voltage Season 3, Episode 30. I'm joined here by my fair-skinned, wonderful... I don't know where this is going. Fair skin, fair hair, wonderful faces. Now, let's just skip all of that bullshit. I'm joined here with Jeremy and Stuart. How are you doing, chaps? I was trying to be romantic and it just didn't work out.
Fair skinned is probably me. Fine, no problem.
Yep.
Right, you know, the ginger hair sort of lends itself to this.
I have questions that I don't want the answers to. Now, the more I think about it, yeah. I don't have questions. I take that back immediately.
I have concerns. I have more than questions.
Yeah, that's fair. I have concerns.
Let's just take a long step away from this whole conversation. Move on.
Yes. So we are today going to just do a whole load of news because we haven't done this for a while. And we keep basically saying to each to ourselves, we should probably do some news at some point. Because we go down the rabbit hole of a particular topic. And obviously we did Room 101. By the way, what were the... You ran the polls for the Room 101s, didn't you, Mr. Langridge? We should probably share the... I checked the results about 3 or 4 days ago, and I was deeply discouraged. So I'm hoping that things have changed
have not. So to clarify, should Facebook go into Room 101, as Jeremy suggested? 95% yes.
Excellent. And I'm assuming the no was you, Bacon.
19 people out of every 20 voted yes. This is...
I mean, it's pretty conclusive, isn't it? I mean, you asked this on Twitter, though, right?
I have to say this is pretty much a preaching to the converted question. The second question, should cats go into Room 101, as Jono suggested? 72% of people said, no, cats are cool. And then 11% of people said yes because I'm a monster. And another 11% of people said I like dogs instead.
I like that you didn't make that a leading question whatsoever.
The way you phrased this, I would argue, may have influenced the results.
Well, I mean, you're not wrong, but there it is. Someone followed up saying, kick the spoiled cat-hating tech hipster out of the podcast. How dare he prefer dogs? and while I think this is unfair, and I usually wouldn't condone someone having a pop at one of the cast, he's 100% bang on right in literally every word of that comment. So no complaints from my point of view.
This whole situation is riddled with fake news, by the way. This is like you going out and doing a survey on healthy eating. It's like Stuart Langridge from the International Institute of Pies and Beer is doing a survey on healthy food. Do you like horrible, disgusting salads that have got no pies in them? Okay. So you do not want Mr. Langridge running your surveys. That's the moral of this particular story. All right. So, you bunch of heathens. We should probably get onto some news then. Jeremy, do you want to maybe start us off?
Sure. So, why don't we go into... We've talked a couple times about the GDPR on the show. And the BBC just had an article with the biggest fines so far. And I was slightly surprised at where they fell. So obviously, given the title, we're rolling on 3 years of the GDPR. The largest fine still is the 211 million euros that was British Airways, which is an interesting thing because I don't think what happened with British Airways was really the spirit of what the GDPR was meant to do. It was really an attack by what seems like a motivated attacker. So it was just a more of a standard breach than some of the other things on the list. Marriott International Hotels is second at 110, very similar situation. Interesting that neither of the first two are tech companies, as it were, which seemed to be one of the initial targets. Then Google is third at 50 million euros. H&M, again, not a tech company, 35 million euros at four. And Amazon rolling up the top five with 35 million euros. So thought it was interesting that three of the top five were in no way tech companies and don't solve some of the problems that I think the EU has with tech in general. Stuart, yeah. as the only one of us currently residing in the EU, curious what your response is here. If you have any thoughts on GDPR, if it's been effective, has it accomplished its goals, etc.
So a couple of thoughts. First of all, the article has since been updated. So Amazon shouldn't be in the list. They were fined for similar sorts of things, but not actually under the GDPR. France have an EE privacy directive, and they were fined under that instead.
Ah, so I read it at about 11 o'clock East last night. So
yeah.
It's been updated very recently then.
Yes, they have updated it today, in fact, which I noticed. But yeah, so now, I mean, the list will say, but Google at the top with 50 million euros and British Airways are a bit further down and so on. But yeah. It is, to be honest with you, disappointing. When Google got fined in 2019, they were one of the earliest, and it was a pretty substantial fine. I mean, fine, not necessarily a substantial fine to Google, but the idea that here is a new thing coming in and we're going to sting people for £50 million or €50 million.
And they appealed and lost, which was setting precedent then because of that.
Oh, yeah, totally. And that looked good. It looked like there was going to be not only teeth, but a willingness to enforce this law against people. And there has been some of that, but not all that much, to be honest with you. And I don't think there's been a serious sea change in the way people think. Now, certainly in the discussions that I'm seeing with companies, the GDPR comes up a lot now where it didn't before. People are aware that they have responsibilities under this, which they weren't before. And to that extent, it has moved the needle. People are now thinking, but what do we do about GDPR compliance? They're not doing it to say we should act like this. They're like, oh, GDPR demands that we don't do this thing even though we want to. But they are at least listening. And that sort of helps. I mean, this is, you know, what's supposed to happen. So it's getting in there. And to that extent, maybe it's worked. But equally, I saw someone mention on Twitter a couple of days ago that all the primarily American news websites which say, because of the GDPR, you're not allowed to see this page, but we're working hard on technology which will allow you to see it. Maybe they're not actually working that hard since they put those notices up 3 years ago and they haven't changed them since. I ran into one like a week ago. I followed a link somewhere and it said, blur, GDPR, so you can't see this. And I thought, what? It's been 3 years. I feel like maybe people are actually trying that hard to fix this. So I think the GDPR has inserted itself into the conversation in a way that it's now become routine for people to say, what are our GDPR requirements while we're building this project? They might do it with a roll of their eyes and a sigh, but they are doing it. Whether it's changing the way Google or Marriott International Hotels or British Airways or Telecom Italia or H&M, whether any of these people are actually going to stop doing this thing rather than treat 35 million euros as the cost of doing business is another question.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I think when California got on board, more American tech companies started taking it seriously because it was, domestic compliance.
CCPA,
Yeah.
And I think that's the way it's got to work. The EU have historically been much more willing to take a stand on this sort of thing and much earlier than other governments, particularly American governments, have chosen to do so. Now, that may be a good thing, maybe a bad thing. We talked about it being potentially a bad thing in the last show. But it means that it can act as a trial balloon. So people trying to put together the CCPA, the California Privacy Law, for example, can look at the GDPR and say, what did they do right? What did they do wrong?
Yeah, right.
And they've got cover for saying, look, they did this and the world didn't fall apart. You know, and I think the EU are kind of happy to be a trial balloon on this sort of thing. So has the GDPR done what we were promised? Dunno.
I think we will eternally be asking that question.
Yeah, but I don't think it's been useless, or a waste of time or a boondoggle.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we have a difference of opinion here by the sound of things.
I just think it's a funny bar when it's, I don't think it's been useless.
That's, yeah.
For how profile it was, at least, not being useless is not exactly a ringing endorsement.
No, this is fair comment, but it's regulation.
Yep.
I can't think of a single piece of regulation which you would point at and go, that's great. And it genuinely did make the world better in all possible ways.
Fair.
Yeah. I don't care.
All right. Let's move on.
I have a bit of news to share.
Go.
So we were talking about NFTs a little while ago. These non-fungible tokens, for people who didn't catch the episode and are not familiar with this, it's basically a way in which you can sell something unique online. So years ago, back in 2007, one of the YouTube meme videos that became
this is the stupid video about the kid. I saw this.
It's called Charlie Bit My Finger.
Yeah.
It got 900 million views. And it's basically two kids. One's a baby. The other one's a little bit older, maybe 5 years old. And this kid bites his finger. And that's it. Anyway, the owners of this, some family in the UK, decided to sell it as an NFT. And I actually saw it when it just I read this news when it just kicked off, and they had about $10,000 worth of donation of bids. It was an auction, and they ended up selling it for $760,000, just under $761,000. And they're going to take it offline, so you'll own it, and this person will have the right to parody as well. And I wonder whether this is going to start becoming a bit of a thing, because I don't know how much YouTube money you make from 900 million views. Someone must know this, right? There's probably a calculator online, generally how much you'll make. But I'm guessing it's not necessarily $760,000.
You think? I mean,
top
YouTubers are millionaires.
Yeah.
And if you get a million views on a video, that's good. And if you've got 900 videos, all of which have got a million views,
that's a good point. So I wonder whether the amount of revenue goes down, though, the more view. Well, once you've hit a certain threshold,
I don't know. I mean, every now and again, you see people do a video saying, "This is how much money I made." And
I mean, I'm sure you
there
appears
to be this huge yawning gulf in between people at the top who are millionaires and someone at the bottom going, "Look, I did this and I got this many views and I got $1,206 this year." And you're like, "Well, that's nice and everything, but which is why people do Patreon and merch and all. It's like being a band, right?
Well, I wonder whether YouTubers will start, especially if, you know, someone puts one of these little videos up and it becomes a viral hit, and then years later when people stop searching, like no one talks about the honey badger anymore, but do you remember when everybody was talking about that video? Wow. The honey badger.
Yeah. No one's talked about like 50 feral hogs or whatever.
So it says the average for a million views is somewhere between $2,000 and $5,000.
Really?
Per million.
So 900 times $5,000 is,
come on, maths boy.
Yeah, I don't know. I won't be able to do
that.
Right?
I'm just going to let you struggle.
900, so 4,500. That's 4.5 million, right?
Is there a calculator on the Ubuntu desktop these days?
$4.5 million, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's loads more than this.
So this begs the question: why the
time
fuck did they sell this as an NFT?
This seems like because they already made the $4.5 million, and now it's not getting a bunch of new views.
Well, that's
so they got the
best.
That's
what I was going to say. I wonder whether when things start trailing down, people
then
are like
you NFT it.
Yeah.
NFT territory.
This seems like a good time to insert a reminder that there is a Bad Voltage NFT sitting out there with one bid at today's price of Ethereum, $145.74. Substantially less. So you can own a piece of NFT history.
Yeah. You totally can. Get into it.
Rarible.com/badvoltage.
Yeah. Anyway, so I thought that was interesting.
So this is cashing out at the end. This is like turning the last bit of your pension into a lump sum or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's the internet. It's the modern sex tape, right? It's let's just have a cash kind of infusion.
Okay, not the analogy I would have picked, but fine. Okay.
We probably shouldn't go down this avenue.
Yeah, what's weird about it is I don't even remember this supposedly super famous thing, although maybe that's just I'm not very in touch because 900 million people have watched it.
Right.
But
I remember it and being underwhelmed by, you know, check out this video, it's hilarious. It's like, it's two kids doing shit that kids do all the time. Like, this is not unique. You know, it's not like the beatbox dog. The beatbox dog was brilliant.
No. I remember someone like one of the late night hosts in America, Stephen Colbert or someone like that.
Right.
At one point wanted to have Grumpy Cat on the show. And then they contacted the owners of Grumpy Cat, who went, yeah, well, obviously we've got to have 5 seats in first class on an airline and this much money got to be put up in all these hotels and everything. They were like, what, for a 5-second joke? I don't think so. Get over yourself.
Oh, but my God.
It turns out clearly what you should do is, I was going to say sell pictures of the cat, but maybe you can sell the cat itself for $760,999.
They're trying to squeeze this miserable cat into an external hard drive so they can sell it as an NFT.
Well, as I understand it, what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to like sell someone an NFT of the thing and then destroy the original artwork, right? In order to make the NFT be the real thing. So, Jono, I'm sure you'd be on board with this. You'd take a picture of the cat, sell the picture of the cat as an NFT, and then drop the cat into a mincer.
Yeah. Well, and I don't want to dwell on this cat thing, but that cat being grumpy is not unique. That's what all cats are.
It's not even uncommon, I'll be honest with you.
Anyway, I don't want to get angry again about cats. Mr. Langridge, what have you got for us?
This one I thought was interesting because it's like, it resembles, Jono, your complaint about Peloton in the Room 101 show, where they keep changing the firmware and
changing
making
stuff.
Rubbish.
It gets slow.
Tesla put out new firmware to their cars, and the older ones, it turned out that the new firmware made the batteries run out faster and they took longer to recharge. So a bunch of people in Norway sued Tesla and won, to the point where Tesla didn't even bother showing up to defend themselves.
I didn't hear about this. This is fascinating.
Well, this is why I'm mentioning it, right? It's in Norway. Apparently, there's a similar case going on in Denmark about this. And I thought
in California last year, I think.
Ah, okay. No, I didn't
see
that.
So hang on. Can you explain what was the complaint was about them reducing battery life?
Yeah, so I don't like that characterization, because what they actually did is made the maximum voltage a little bit less, because they had a couple problems with fires in the S.
Okay.
So they were limiting how much you could charge it at the very upper boundary, which in theory does mean the car will go less far, but it's not like they made the battery drain faster.
Yeah, but from a customer from the customer's point of view, right, owners of Tesla Model S vehicles, quoting from the article here, owners of Tesla Model S vehicles purchased between 2013 and 2015 found that after they downloaded and installed the code in 2018, the electric batteries powering their cars ran out of juice faster than usual and took longer to recharge. So that is, from a customer's point of view, I bought a thing and then after I'd bought it and given you the money, you reached out from Tesla headquarters and made it crapper. Now, they may have had reasons for that.
Yeah, it turns out if you bought something that's basically a piece of technology with 4 wheels, they learned a bunch of information about battery degradation in the 5 years since they shipped it, and they said, we're going to extend the life of your battery by making it charge slower, which reduces heat, which, given battery dynamics, makes a lot of sense, and we're going to limit the upper range of how far it will charge, because they've literally been starting on fire. This seems like solid engineering principles
applied. It doesn't seem that controversial to me.
No.
That seems like a perfectly reasonable argument for Tesla to have made in contest. And they didn't even show up.
Like most other car manufacturers would have had to recall their cars and change out things and inconvenience you Tesla sent you an over-the-air update in software, fixed it for you.
Well, and maybe the reason why Tesla didn't show up is because, I mean, according to the article, which, by the way, should be noted is the Register, which is not a reliable source, okay? But it said that the total for all of the payouts that they made was $490,000. That's nothing. It's probably just cheaper for them to just pay it.
Them sending one lawyer would have cost them more than that.
Yeah. I think that's probably why. I mean, the optics aren't great.
They're not.
The fact that they didn't show up.
This is the thing. If Tesla are going to say, well, this is back to the thing we said 2 minutes ago. They're going to say, well, having to be found guilty in court of screwing customers over, but it's only $500,000, so who cares? Yeah, the optics right. do not look great for doing this sort of thing.
Well, what I mean is the optics of them not showing up to the court. Like them yeah. them deciding financially it's going to be cheaper to just, you know, these people are pissed off. Let's just give them some money and we'll make good on it. And then we'll just save everybody a bunch of heartache. Makes sense.
Well, hang on, right. The bit in Fight Club where Edward Norton explains that that's how his company works with recalls. You know you're supposed to not like the company for that, right?
My point is...
You're not going to go, yay! Sensible capitalism. No,
my point here is they went to court. They made a complaint. They consider their complaint reasonable. I think there's questions around that, to Jeremy's point. But they won, and they got paid for it. So it was good for the yeah. people who went to court. Tesla didn't want to spend a whole load of extra money in fighting it. It's good for them. This seems like a good win. I mean... And I don't, to Jeremy's point, look, this is the world we live in, right? If you go and buy a piece of technology that gets updates over the air, it's going to change. Like, where do you draw the line? I mean, could we arguably say, well, hang on a second, I got this update that added the ability to watch Netflix on my Tesla, and I'm unhappy the fact that they're not improving the drivability of the car, therefore I'm going to sue them? Like, where do you draw the line between like when your product changes? It's like a unique problem that we've got that's not happened in history, right? Because
it is. I think what maybe is underappreciated, and Tesla's obviously not going to add this to their marketing, but you are legitimately buying a piece of technology that happens to drive on roads, not a traditional car in the way that you think about it.
Yeah.
And that comes with a whole bunch of positives, but it also comes with negatives because things are a trade-off.
I certainly agree that that's what Tesla want you to think, but I would dispute
it's the fact absolutely. That, just look at their release, their change notes. I mean, it's yeah, they add, yeah.
But the so flip side of that is
they released a release on the 3 about a year ago that made your car 0.2 seconds faster. Which, if you're into cars and you're into sports cars, that's thousands of dollars normally and a ton of work. And they were just one day your car was just faster. Like that's yeah. unheard of in automotive history. It's going to come with some bumps along the road.
I agree with you, but that does not mean that because Tesla have stated that, yeah, they haven't stated, but they're attempting to imply that you're buying a piece of technology and reaching out and changing it after you bought it is a perfectly legitimate and reasonable thing to do, and that's the way of the future. Just because they're saying that does not mean that it's been established that that's the case. And court cases like this are exactly about the distinction between maybe this is going to be the future for everything we buy, but it currently isn't.
You see, I don't think that Tesla are saying that. I think I disagree with both of you because I don't think Tesla in any
way... I don't think they are. No, I said they weren't.
Oh, right. Okay. Because Tesla, when you go buy a Tesla, you buy a car. They call it a car. It's stated that it's a car. But in reality, it's basically an Android phone with a giant battery and wheels stuck to the bottom of it, right? I mean, it's like, I mean, I may be misrepresenting Tesla a little bit, and I love Teslas, but yeah, it's changing. But you know, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to go and buy those, and this kind of stuff is going to happen. And like Jeremy said, it swings in two directions. Like your example about speeding the car up is a huge deal for a lot of people.
Yeah,
but I can also definitely. See why these people were pissed off when when they were having battery issues. I get why that would happen, especially if your expectations is it's a car and it doesn't change after you've bought it, you know? So, yeah. Fascinating. We're going to see more of this, which is going to be interesting.
Sure. I think we're going to see lots more. As IoT-ness gets wedged into everything we own.
Yes.
Yeah.
the Keurig things and stuff like that. This is going to happen with everything.
Yeah. Before we go on, what do you think it's not going to happen to? Where is technology not going to impact? Like,
I mean, I hate this answer, but nowhere.
I can't think of... The best thing I can come up with is consumable stuff. Like, I can't see how technology can affect an orange that I've already bought.
Like toilet roll. Like fundamentally analog things. Like toilet roll, condoms, oranges, vegetables.
I don't think we'll see a new orange anytime soon from a technology perspective.
No, that's the thing.
I can't see,
because the whole point of this kind of thing is to open up things like new revenue streams. You don't keep consumable stuff around for long enough. I mean, but the box you get
in, wouldn't the technological version of toilet paper be a bidet?
Yeah, or actually no, probably the technological version of toilet paper would be toilet paper just with scrolling adverts on it.
That's where Google wants us to get us with that.
Well, specifically adverts for companies you don't like.
That's actually a really great idea.
Yeah,
probably exists.
This is a startup. There's got to be a way in which you can. Oh, can you imagine if this is an idea for the future, right? Can you imagine if you gave toilet paper away for free to people, right? And then companies will pay the toilets. Companies will pay, you know, Langridge Paper money to go and print their ads of the people they don't like on them, which pays for the cost of the rolls to be then distributed to people.
If you can come up with a way of making foldable, crumpleable, feels like paper, electronic paper, which you can talk to over the air, which is so cheap that people can literally afford to wipe their ass on it and throw it away, you have entirely revolutionized the universe. Don't do bog roll first. Right?
I don't mean electronic paper. I mean like manual. I mean like
he wants the Remarkable 3 version of toilet paper.
Let's say for the sake of argument, right? Just an example. Let's say Langridge Paper has got an offering, and I can pay you $1,000, right? And you will print a roll of toilet paper with cats' faces on, right?
Right.
Then what happens is 50 of these rolls are made available. Jeremy's just too cheap, so he actually ends up getting a roll of this. And then he has a big lunch, and then he's looking at these cats. So
I have just Googled the words custom toilet roll, and I don't want to disappoint you here, entrepreneur. But you are not the first person to think of this idea.
Yeah, but giving the rolls away for free is the key thing. Anyway, God, this is like Y Combinator.
well, kinda.
You know, there's so many dumb companies around. It's only a matter of time before.
Wow, printed TP powered by Shopify is the first hit. So,
well, yeah. So here's the thing. Like, this is a complete divergence away from the subject, but I got interviewed by a guy a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things he asked was, are there any regrets you have for your career? And I said, well, it's not really a regret, but it's something that I've thought about quite a bit. It's when I was just starting to get into, you know, I was going through university and then came out of university and just starting to become a tech person. The very beginning of my career is when the dot-com boom was going on, 98 or so. And at the time, I was sort of vaguely aware it was going on, but I was concerned with things like how we were just at university and just renting a flat, and I just got married and so on. Yeah. So, you know, and attempting to be a graduate trainee COBOL programmer for Norwich Union and going backwards and forwards to work on a moped every day in the rain. And I wasn't really thinking about the dot-com boom. But one of the things I've thought about since is, I don't know whether you could honestly just rock up with some ridiculous idea like custom printable toilet roll and make $400 million like pets.com.
Back then? Look at Webvan and pets.com. And
You see, yeah, this is the thing. You can name things like pets.com and so on. But so there are two thoughts in there about that. The first one is, I don't know if that works if you're in Norwich in England rather than in San Francisco.
Probably not.
That's a good point.
But secondly, I don't know. It's the sort of thing where people will sneeringly go, yeah, if you literally had any idea, then it's fine. But I think a lot of it might have been because someone's brother knew a VC or something like that. I don't know if you could literally just have no idea, have no contacts, and just rock up in town with a pitch deck.
Probably not.
And get the money. And so I don't know whether it's a regret, because the second thought is then, why am I not doing it now? You know, but
this is we should talk
days.
About in a yeah. show.
I bring this up because Jono, you've probably thought about it. Jeremy was probably running a fucking sneaker store or something in this town and taking it public at the same time.
There is some story like that in the past, if I remember right, about Jeremy. But we should talk about in an episode sometime about companies in different parts of the world. Right, because you've got all these tech hubs that are forming in London, Berlin, Paris, and then, you know, not just Silicon Valley, like places like Boston and New York and whatever else. And I'd be interested to talk about, like, you always hear about the Silicon Valley big success stories, but what about these other companies around there? Like, are you at a disadvantage if you're in Boston, for example, or in Birmingham or London or whatever? That'd be an interesting thing for us to dig into.
Write it down in the planning doc.
I'm putting it into the planning doc.
It will be interesting. I mean, one of the nice things there is, Jeremy, you've presumably got a good sense of the distinction between New York City and Boston.
Silicon Alley, as it's called, yeah.
Right. Oh, is that what it's called? Okay, yeah. But because I haven't really got that because, yeah, there's a fairly big distinction between Birmingham and London. But then there's a big distinction between London and San Francisco. But New York is the other big place.
As far as tech goes, I think you were at a substantial disadvantage if you weren't in the Bay Area up until recently. I think that's definitely in the last few years changed. And I think the pandemic has accelerated it changing. You look at Miami's now like the new VC hub where everyone wants to go to.
Yeah.
Austin, there's a bunch of people moving there. I think it's changed, but there's still a density of people in the Bay Area that just having that density creates a kind of activity that's difficult to replicate, but it's changing.
That's I don't know very much about this, but that's really interesting. So
I put it in the doc. We will talk about it in the future.
So
what's next?
Speaking of things people probably regret, did you see that Internet Explorer 11 is going to be retired on June 15th of 2022?
I did.
Yeah. I honestly didn't realize it was still a thing.
So here, though, is the greatest part about the announcement. By moving to Microsoft Edge, you get everything described above, plus you'll be able to extend the life of your legacy websites and apps well beyond Internet Explorer 11 desktop application retirement using IE mode. Internet Explorer mode in Microsoft Edge will be supported through at least 2029. And what blows my mind here is I don't know if I could think of a more stark difference between Google and Microsoft, where Google's what was the last one? Google Cloud Print. It was like, I know you've been using this for years. Find a new replacement in the next month. Microsoft announces it's canceling IE11 in 2022 with an extended support option through at least 2029.
Yeah, but
take a lesson from this.
But it's incredible. That's,
There is a reason that they've still got 90% of the desktops in the world, because they care about this stuff.
Yeah.
You know. And every time, so remember when they bumped the support date on Windows XP? And everyone was like, why are you still running Windows XP? And loads of companies like, we still totally are. Should we be thinking about upgrading now? And realistically, if you've got something that requires IE11 today, right? You've gone 10 years and haven't put in any effort to modernize it, and you haven't bought a replacement for it. If you're still running it today, then you still need it. And no one's going to invest the huge amount of effort it's going to take to fix something like that, because it's probably not something that you built in the first place. So you're stuck with it forever.
I think there's a lot of people out there. A lot of people who are running something like XP or running Internet Explorer for very specific reasons, right? Like they need some internal app to work, like some time tracking software or something like that.
Yeah.
And they've just decided, I will never upgrade this thing again.
No, I'm going to check this IE mode box and I'll see you in 2030.
Yeah. Yeah, just
everything will break.
You know what IE mode is, right?
Them embedding the old code in Edge, I would guess.
Yeah, it's basically an entire
which means someone's role at Microsoft, Edge. Multiple someone's roles at Microsoft, is maintain IE 11's engine for a decade.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Someone's going to be there porting Trident to Windows 22 or something.
I would love to interview someone like that. Someone who's got to maintain these like ancient legacy systems.
That'd be a
fascinating job to hear about, you know?
But, I mean, I said 5 minutes ago, I came out of university and became a COBOL programmer.
Yeah.
And what I was doing was working on stuff which had been written 30 years previously. Because it worked. Right. Changing it would be a catastrophic amount of effort. I mean, I was doing Y2K stuff when I first went to Norwich Union. You know, going through stuff that said PIC 99 and changing it to PIC 9999, so you had 4-digit years. Not the most.
This certainly explains a lot of your anger management problems.
Not the most exciting job I've ever had in my entire life. It's better than the Nutridol one. But
I'm glad it happened, because otherwise you'd have just been this very calm,
easy
individual.
Going, yeah.
But instead, the angry, raging bastard that you've become, I think is, we all love that angry, raging bastard.
You see the words identification division one too many times, you just lose it. But I think that's the thing. Jeremy, exactly like you say, you've got this thing which works, and you're just not going to touch it. Why would you touch it? It works.
Yeah.
You know, especially when it's not like you can say, okay, I'd like a modern replacement for this, and have some company go, okay, we'll give you a thing which does everything that the existing one does. There'll be no trouble in migrating to it, and it gives you extra features. No, it'll be, that thing that you want to replace it with, we're going to lose half the features. It won't work. You'll have to pay us loads more to migrate, and we're going to charge you a monthly fee for it.
And I think this is a thing that's very easy for folks like us who are, even if we don't live in the Bay Area, very steeped in the tech scene. Every stack we see is, I can't believe you're on a version of Node that's 6 months old. That's bonkers. Or like there's an insurance company in Topeka, Kansas, legitimately that cares about IE 11 being supported to 2030.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like our entire intranet's based on it. And the intranet is important because the expenses system is built into the intranet.
Exactly.
And we can't replace the expenses system because the company who we bought it from went bust in 2004. So what are we going to do?
So I do have another Google one. Did you also see that AMP pages no longer get preferential treatment in Google search?
I did.
They don't?
We have talked about AMP at length in the past. Yeah, it says Google is rolling out a significant change as part of their page experience ranking algorithm that will roll out in June of 2021. From the release of the Core Web Vitals and the page experience algorithm, there is no longer any preferential treatment for accelerated mobile pages in Google search results, top story carousels, or Google News. Google will even remove the AMP badge icon from all search results.
We have won.
I did not like AMP, I will say.
The thing which disappoints me about it is that the technology, pretty much okay. The idea of saying, we would like you to essentially create a second version of web pages with all of your crap stripped out so the Googlebot can read it, is similar in concept to having an RSS feed with all of your stories in it. Right.
Yeah,
it's a way that it's machine readable that people can automatically detect and so on. That seems fine. But then, Google then went, okay, if you don't do this, we will de facto mark you down in search by marking everyone who does do it up. Right. And it stopped being, hey, here is an interesting technological thing, and started becoming a way of Google strong arming people into doing stuff. And everybody hated the fact that they had to do it.
Yep.
Did you see that they also added the follow feature to Chrome, which is just subscribing to RSS feeds?
It's just subscribing to RSS feeds. I have decided.
I don't know what's going on.
You see, here's the thing. My instinctive reaction. John, I don't know if you saw this.
No.
So you can follow a web. Google are going to detect when a website is followable and give you the option to follow it, at which point news stories and stuff, and that will show up in Chrome. It's an RSS reader built into Chrome, just like Firefox used to have 15 years ago, where you got the little RSS icon in the bar. Yep. It's just that.
I forgot about that.
I have decided on balance, my instinctive reaction was just to be snarky about this. But I've decided that instead of going, Google, you've got no idea, this is just RSS, why don't you get it? I'm going to go, nah, let's get on board with this. Because they haven't invented a new weird thing. They haven't made it Google specific. They haven't made it so you're tied into it. This is Google supporting RSS.
The open web.
Open standard, which everyone can have on the open web, and putting it in Chrome and putting it up front in Chrome will massively accentuate the number of people who want to do this, which makes it better for everybody. And the only reason to take the piss is because they're presenting it like it's a new thing when we all know it's 15 years old.
It's just like Google Reader, but different.
Yeah.
I mean, so, I think it makes perfect sense because the concept of RSS, you've got to be kind of technical to understand that as a concept. But a follow button is well understood in the current culture of using tech. And who cares? Like, if what I don't get is who the fuck's going to use this? Like, that's not how people consume information anymore.
I think people are starting to consume information in more old school ways. You look at the reemergence of newsletters. I think people's patterns are starting to change a little bit.
That sounds like another interesting show topic.
It does, especially if your stipulation is people don't consume news this way anymore, which means you're suggesting that the way people consume news is from their Facebook feed and no other way.
For a certain demographic of people, personally.
No,
I would say
well,
that's
I'm
correct.
Not necessarily talking about just about news. What I'm talking about is like, you know, as we use the web and we're just bouncing around like people's blogs and various websites, I just think the concept of subscribing to something at a website is certainly less common than it used to be, but we do subscribe in social media. And
I
some
think
people
Substack
will obviously
would disagree with you.
Well, yeah, but
yeah,
I'm talking about the general public. I'm not talking about technical people, right? And you could argue, of course, there's Medium, right? Some people are following people on Medium. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. What I'm saying is that I wouldn't say that the vast majority of people who are using the internet are going around subscribing to websites.
I am short of stats on it. But if people were to change back to doing things that way, largely, that benefits the open web generally. But it also benefits Google. Because from Google's point of view, as long as you're doing stuff on the web, they're happy with it.
Yep.
Whereas Facebook, you have to come to Facebook to get their thing. If everyone stops using Facebook, Facebook go bust. In order for Google to stop being valuable, the web as a whole has to go away, which is why their big threat is things like Apple News and stuff like that, right? But from Google's point of view, if you go all over the web and subscribe to stuff, they're just as happy with you doing that as you coming to news.google.com or Twitter or whatever to get it. They don't care. As long as you're using the web, they're still in. So them encouraging people to do this is good for Google, strategically.
Yeah. What's interesting about this is if we're talking about outside of the social media platforms, right? So, for example, I love Google News because as a general rule, it does show me news that I care about. Sometimes it will go down a path and I'll just say, I don't want to see anything about the Kardashians or whatever. But generally, it's okay. But we're kind of at this point in our culture where we know that there's a lot of fake news and biased news out there. So websites recommending news can be abused. So maybe that will kind of usher in an era of people manually going and subscribing to things. But then my concern will be they'll only subscribe to the news stories that have the messages that they want to hear, right?
It creates bubbles.
It doesn't pop the bubble. It just changes the bubble.
Yeah. But the flip side of that is I think, and this might be wishful thinking on my part, but I think people are starting to become suspicious of gatekeepers. People who say, well, we can mediate the experience on your behalf so you don't have to do all that stress of going out and finding
things. This sounds like a show.
We'll provide you a curated experience. I think that did seem like a good thing. There's way too much stuff out there and I want someone to help choose it for me. But I think the first iteration of that bunch of companies did that because they were trying to provide a decent curated experience and then realized that there's no way of getting paid if you do that. And so increasingly now what you see is sponsored news and ad takeovers and so on. And I think, and again, this might be wishful thinking from my point of view, but I think people are starting to think, it doesn't feel very authentic to have someone choose what I should see because they keep choosing stuff that pays them money rather than that is interesting for me.
I think people think that when it challenges their perception of the world.
Or tries to sell them something they're not interested in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Put it in the planning deck.
But wow. Yeah, this is a good show.
It's just fodder for new shows.
We're just coming up with loads of new ideas for shows. This is brilliant. We're actually saving ourselves work.
what you're listening to, people, here is a sort of a really, really long planning session. Just happens to be a show.
Little behind the scenes. I have something I'd like to talk to you about briefly, which is not necessarily related to tech. But have you both noticed the increased amount of news about UFOs recently?
Yes.
Have you seen this?
Well, yeah. So there is a reason.
So the back, a little bit of backstory for people who are not familiar with this. So for years, people have been talking about UFOs, right? And what was interesting is that with the advent of the cell phone camera, the amount of UFO reporting seemed to kind of take a bit of a dip, right? Like people were often taking videos with their old camcorders and whatever else. But there's always been a very passionate group of people who've been into UFOs.
Yes.
But what's been interesting, I think, is in the last couple of years, and especially in the last, really the last couple of months, I think it's the Pentagon, they used to have an office that was dedicated to what they call unidentified aerial phenomenon. And they ended up shutting it down. And the guy who ran it ended up doing a whole bunch of research outside of that. And they restarted that program recently. And there's been a number of people who work for who work in the military. And video has been unclassified and released, or declassified and released, which is showing some of these crafts that can just make aerial changes that we don't currently have access to that kind of technology, at least that we're aware of. So this could be in the US, it could be, you know, Russian or Chinese drones or whatever else. But the Senate Intelligence Committee is basically demanding a hearing, a report. They're actually doing some research into it. And I think it's going to be in the next couple of months that they have to go and report on this. So this is becoming like more and more of a thing. And essentially the government now is not denying this. So for what, 50 years? This has all been denied. Like the government has never, ever acknowledged that this is a thing. And now they're starting to acknowledge that this is actually a thing. I just think it's interesting, the uptick in this and the change in tone in recent years, I think, especially in the last 6 months, is notable.
It's a bit more nuanced than that, in my opinion. So a couple of things should be stated up front. The first one is that there's a bunch of talk about UFOs, by which you mean unidentified flying objects. No one thinks they're aliens, right? Nobody thinks this. Nobody credible thinks this.
Of course people think there are aliens. Many people think there are aliens. All right,
fine. No one credible thinks these are aliens. And that's why this discussion is hard to have in public. Because someone says, the Pentagon admitted there are UFOs. Like, yeah, there was a thing, it was flying, and we didn't know what it was. That's what makes it a UFO. No one is saying it's aliens from the planet Zanussi. But literally every newspaper headline says, oh my God, aliens attack the following day, right?
They are. No, you're misrepresenting. No, most news are not saying that. Most
literally
news
the only reason there has been all this talk about it is because you can say things like, wow, there's UFOs and the Pentagon are admitting it.
No, I mean,
and
yeah,
everyone
you
goes,
are
oh,
you
is
are
it aliens?
Being...
No.
You are being uncharacteristically sensational about this. I mean, there are some people who are doing that, nutcases, right? But I think most of the news reporting that I've seen, at least on credible sites, has been, hey, this is kind of interesting that the Pentagon's acknowledging that there's some weird craft that are appearing in protected airspace and that we need to figure out what it is.
Certainly historically the attitude to talking about this sort of thing from the Pentagon has been, we don't comment on stuff like this, shove off, no discussions about it, we're not interested.
Yeah, exactly.
And you do get the impression that was just, you know, this policy is a lot easier for us to just go, we just don't talk about this sort of thing. Go away.
If your comment is always no comment, you never have to comment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are, from back in the 50s and so on, there are, since declassified reports from high up government officials who were like, are aliens real? Are these really spacecraft from another planet? We would very much like to know if they are. And not just saying they don't have any evidence one way or the other, but bemoaning the lack of such evidence, right? So all the Area 51 nutcases have glossed over the fact that they did really want it to be the truth. They were like, maybe we can genuinely get like alien space technology and ray guns and what have you. This would be great. But that was in the 50s. I mean, right. Since then, 70 years on, yeah, if you spend your entire career flying around in the sky, I'm assuming you're going to see a couple of things you didn't know what they were. And yeah, some of them seem to have changed direction quickly or whatever. But I think what's interesting here is mostly the Pentagon appeared to say, yeah, we actually have reports on this. And everyone went, yeah, well, we knew that you had them, right? You must have had.
Yeah. Having the reports is not the complicated bit.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And admitting that you have the reports is not somehow giving credibility to the idea that Martians came to attack the US Air Force.
What I think is especially interesting about this is, and putting all the alien stuff to one side, is if something appears in a country's airspace, that's a problem, right? If an unapproved craft appears in a country's airspace, that's an issue because it could be a threat. What I think makes it even more concerning is when the thing that is moving can make can change its direction at breakneck speeds. So what I thought was really interesting is that 60 Minutes, you know, a pretty respectable program, did a feature on this recently, and it's actually well worth watching. And there were these two people who work for the US Army, this woman and this guy, and they were out flying and they saw this thing. And if I remember correctly, they said that this thing moved, the speed that it moved, it was like, it basically moves something like 50, 60,000 feet in a second, right? And there just isn't anything that they were like, we know this is not something that we have technology for, right? So if there is another country, you know, a potentially hostile country, whether it's China or Russia or whatever, that has that kind of technology and it's in your airspace, putting the aliens thing to one side, that's an issue. That's something you should look into. Now, whether it is little green men kind of coming to Earth is a whole separate question. But putting that to one side, you've got to look into it.
But yeah, I know what you mean.
Right. It sounds like you are skeptical of aliens.
Just
Mr.
Dutch.
Language.
But I think...
I'm genuinely surprised by that.
I am as well. Why are you skeptical?
Because there haven't been any.
But your contention is in a space that is likely infinite, at least to the human mind, that the only sentient form of life ever to be formed is here?
Whether I believe there is life elsewhere is an entirely different question to whether I believe it has come here and shown itself.
That is an entirely different question.
And shown itself only to drunk people late at night.
That is a fair distinction. I thought you meant the former, not the latter.
Arthur C. Clarke used to talk about what he called shy phenomena. Things which... there were lots and lots of stories about, but were curiously reluctant to appear on film. And
right.
Jono, your point about how everyone on Earth, well, sorry, everyone in about half of Earth, now has a camera in their pocket, is, to my mind, one of the best examples of why Bigfoot isn't real. Because for every one person who happened to go up into the woods in 1972 with a Super 8 camera in order to film Bigfoot, now literally everyone in the woods has a camera in their pocket and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Sasquatch sightings, right?
Yeah.
And aliens are the same thing. The advantage with this stuff is that if you are in a F-14 or something, and a mysterious thingy appears in front of you, it's not like you're reliant on the pilot going, I saw this thing and it was blue and it went really fast. It's being tracked by a million kajillion different radar thingies and what have you, right? So they should have a whole bunch of data. And this is what this chap Elizondo, who, according to the Washington Post article, ran the secret in the basement group in the Pentagon who investigated this stuff. It's not at all clear to me whether this guy actually did do this or what.
No, he did. As far as I'm aware, he did. I think he was the guy who was interviewed on 60 Minutes.
Hmm. Yeah. I think.
I'm not 100% certain on that.
Yeah. And this guy, Reed, said that this guy, Elizondo, is the one who ran this. But whatever, right? If he's doing it, one of the things he said was, we've got military data collection capabilities. Point to this stuff. This is the thing, right? These things are being filmed on military cameras and they're being seen by military radar and so on. So they ought to be able to quantify how fast did this thing move? Was it really there? What might have caused it? You know, in a way much better than some bloke's shaky camcorder thing.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it is the military, I think, makes it a lot more compelling and a lot more objective. Like you say, they've got cameras mounted to those airplanes that can... I mean, one of the things they said as well was that when this thing... when they were filming it, right? Because they've got the cameras on the planes and they can track the velocity of another craft based upon it, right? It's basically got this kind of like... pretty complex image detection, and it was too quick. It moved too quickly for the camera to track it. That's pretty compelling. Now, again, it wouldn't surprise me at all if this is a drone or whatever, but the fact that something can move that quickly. And the other thing that I thought was interesting is that a lot of these craft don't seem to have any, I forget the technical term, like, but you know, and when you've got propulsion, you'll see like the trails that kind of come off the side of it. That they didn't have any of that as well. Like, there's no heat register.
Well, I mean, it's kind of
spooky.
From my point of view, I feel like they must have been filming these things for years and years and years and years and have collected tons and tons and tons of data. So I don't get why we don't know more about them.
Well, and I wonder why this is... If
it's real, you know, this is the point.
I believe that the military are telling the truth in this particular case. What I don't know, and I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theory lunatic because I'm not, but I don't know why they're starting to share this information now. It seems like there's been a lot of this kind of coming out over the course of the next 3 or 4 weeks, over the last 3 or 4 weeks. And I wonder why now, like why I think they've probably got hundreds and hundreds of these reports from pilots and whatever else that are sitting inside. But why now? Why is it public news that the Senate Intelligence Committee is requesting a report?
Like, I agree with you, but I feel like I ought to point out, when you said you don't want to sound like a conspiracy theory lunatic, you do in fact sound quite like a conspiracy theory lunatic.
Well, by asking that, you think by asking that question, that's...
A lot of times what happens with things like this is one credible piece of information either got foiled or declassified for whatever reason and became the base of something where it's no longer plausibly deniable, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think asking the question makes me a conspiracy theory lunatic. I think me saying there's a giant government conspiracy to keep the people in the dark makes me sound like a conspiracy, and I don't believe that.
Asking the question why now, I can't think why. The obvious answer to that is now's when a journalist found out about it or something. If there's any other answer to that question, it sort of implies... are they trying to distract us from something or whatever? Which does sound like conspiracy.
No, I'm asking that question. And it may be like the answer may be, to Jeremy's point, let's say something got declassified or something got leaked by a whistleblower and then it's become a thing. I'm perfectly happy to buy that. I just want to know what happened. And I don't know what happened to generate this. There's a lot of news about this right now. So,
yep. So reeling it in, as I know we're going a little bit long here, was there any other must-cover news on either of your agendas?
I don't
agendas?
Think so.
We didn't talk about Amazon and MGM or Freenode or...
No,
NVIDIA
no,
capping
well,
crypto cards.
We may have to do more news next time.
Yeah,
I know, right. Fuchsia's in the wild.
Fuchsia.
Yep.
There's loads of stuff going on.
Yeah.
But we've now got enough shows. We've got a bunch more news, and we've now got at least two more ideas for shows.
Yeah. Plus, it's been a very productive episode.
This is great. We're queued up now until July or something.
And on that bombshell, I think that wraps up the show, does it not, Mr. Langridge?
It does. I mean, seriously, there's tons more news, and I can't have a go at John about the guy.
It turns out when we don't talk about news for a while, there's a lot of interesting news.
Yeah, I know. You see, and I wanted to have a pop at John about the guy who did a Zoom meeting while he was driving and everything, but we don't get the chance, so...
We do have a unique opportunity here, listeners, in that Jono's audio has stopped, so he can hear Stuart and I talking and is currently reacting to Stuart and I talking, but he cannot interject anything, so... It's a little funny, but we'll be nice and not take advantage of this. Thanks again to Marius for mixing this show and others.
Yes, go to nerdzoom.media.
And on that Baconio bombshell, thanks for listening.